Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. I'm Rachel Isaacs, a student from Manalapa, New Jersey, and the engineer for this program. We look forward to learning some Torah with you today. Thank you for tuning in. Today we are joined by Rabbi Meir Schweiger, a faculty member and the Mashkiach Ruchani, or spiritual guide, at Pardes. He will be teaching us about Parshat Chukat. A few quick announcements, and then we'll hand it over to Rabbi Schweiger. Your participation and feedback is vital for the success of the podcast series. Please send us comments on the episode, where you live, and how you heard about us. Send your email to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thank you. That's it, and now Rabbi Schweiger.
Thank you, Rachel. This week's parsha is Parshat Chukat. And I just want to inject that my apologies to the people who are in the diaspora, because in fact you are a parsha behind. So for you, this is Parshat Korach, and we will try to get in another session on Korach. But for Israelis, this week the parsha is Parshat Chukat. Parshat Chukat begins with a discussion of the red heifer. In chapter 19, verse 2, it says, Zot Chukat HaTorah, which I will translate, this is the statute of the Torah, Asher Tziva Hashem Lemor, which God commanded. Daber al Bnei Israel, speak to the Jewish people, V'yikhu Elecha Para Aduma, let them take to you a red heifer. Tamima, complete. Asher Ein Bamum, which has no blemish. Asher Lo Ala Aleha Ol, upon which there has been no yoke. What is the meaning of the word chok? The root has to do with the idea of engraving, something which is deeply embedded, something which is perhaps immutable. The rabbis generally associate the idea of a chok as a law that defies our reason. And the explanation for this is that it isn't just that it's difficult to come up with a rationale, some sort of meaning that we can find, but that when I examine the law, it seems to be that there are internal contradictions which create an absurdity. The red heifer is one such example, and perhaps the classic example of a situation of a law which seems to be totally irrational, filled with contradictions. I just read verse 2, where we speak about what are the characteristics of the red heifer. It's supposed to be, number one, complete, which the rabbis understand to mean completely red, so there's no allowance of a black hair or any white hairs. It's supposed to be unblemished. And when we read further in verses 3 and 4, the red heifer is supposed to be given to the charge of Eleazar the priest. He is to take it outside of the camp, slaughter it, take the blood with his finger, sprinkle it towards the tent of meeting 7 times. And then in verse 5, he's supposed to burn the heifer totally. If I look at the points that I've just mentioned, the red heifer is supposed to be unblemished. It is slaughtered by a priest. Its blood is sprinkled. It's subsequently burned totally. All of these features characterize sacrifices and a sacrificial service. But there's one problem. Sacrifices are supposed to be brought in the framework of the temple. In fact, in chapter 17 in Leviticus, we're told explicitly not to bring sacrifices outside of the realm of the temple. So that here the Torah is commanding us to do something which goes against all the other rules we have. We're being told to do sacrificial rites outside of the temple. One contradiction. Second contradiction. In verse 7, we're told that the priest who has been involved in this process has to bathe his body in water and subsequently can enter the camp, and that he is to be unclean until the evening. And subsequently we said, whoever burns the red heifer, okay, whoever gathers the ashes of the red heifer, all of the people involved in the process of gathering, creating the ashes of the red heifer, all become ritually impure through that contact. And yet, we're told in subsequent verses, and perhaps specifically verse 17, verse 18, that the whole purpose of the ashes of the red heifer is to have them sprinkled on anyone who has become impure through contact with the dead body as part of their purification process. And hence you have the rabbinic comment that says that I have the following anomaly. The red heifer makes pure those who are impure, but makes impure those who are pure. So what is it? Is it a means of a purification, or is it a means of defilement? Third problem. In verse 17, as part of the purification process, it isn't just that I take the ashes of the red heifer and sprinkle them on the one who is ritually impure, but we're told that I take, and the term that's used actually is the dust of the burning of this animal, and I put upon it living water in a utensil. So that the purification process is coming about as a result of mixing ashes, which are totally devoid of any moisture, are totally dry, have been stripped of any of the liquids within it, and I'm supposed to mix it with living water, which the rabbis understand to mean spring water. And it's that combination that I sprinkle on the person who is impure. So once again, I am now combining what seem to be contradictory elements, taking ashes and mixing them together with living water. I mentioned a moment ago, the purpose of the ashes of the red heifer is to purify one who has come in contact with a dead body, who as a result of that becomes ritually impure for a period of 7 days. I would like to suggest that the riddle of the red heifer is simply a reflection of the riddle of life. The contradictions involved in this service and processing of the red heifer reflect the contradictions that we experience in our lives. And now I'd like to be a little bit more specific. The red heifer is addressing a situation of someone who's come in contact with death. On other occasions, I've mentioned a classic commentary on the Chumash, Rabbi Samsel Raphael Hirsch, who was an Orthodox rabbi in Germany in the 1800s, whose commentary is very much focused on trying to give philosophical explanations for the various laws that we have. And in our section, what he does is to discuss the meaning of defilement, ritual impurity, when one comes in contact with a dead body. And the way he describes it is as follows. When you see a dead body, there are two basic issues that are raised, which I think are true whenever anyone has contact with death. One issue that's raised is, what is the meaning of life when you see a corpse? We speak a lot about human grandeur, empowerment. But when I see a dead body, it seems to mock those beliefs. In fact, it seems to say that life is perhaps absurd. Life is an illusion. The more that we think that we are all powerful, all of a sudden we're confronted with a harsh reality, which shows how limited and how vulnerable we really are. And there is a second issue. For many people, death raises a very serious theological question of, is there a God? Where is God? How could God allow this thing to happen? How many times have I heard people who have raised this question in terms of the Holocaust? If there really is a God, how could God have allowed for babies to be butchered? I would like to add that these are natural, healthy questions that people should raise when they're confronted by death. And it's these questions that create a reality of defilement. What do I mean by that? We would like to look at the world in very rosy terms, very idealistic terms. We would like to believe that people are all powerful, that people have grandeur, that people are in the image of God. And we would like to believe that there is a God who somehow is involved in the world, ordering the world, caring for the world, and acts in a way which is just and kind. And all of a sudden, this ideal vision is shattered. That's defilement. The period of defilement is meant to be a period where a person confronts those issues and is able to once again affirm this ideal, to affirm that yes, there is a God in the world. Yes, human beings are in the image of God. Human beings do have grandeur and dignity. By taking the ashes of the red heifer and mixing them with living water, I mentioned earlier that the ashes in the Hebrew are described by the word afar, which means dust. And we're all familiar with what it says in the beginning of Genesis, when God curses Adam and says to him, "For you are dust, and to dust you shall return." so that the ashes of the red heifer symbolize human mortality. The living water is clearly the reflection of life, vitality. By mixing the two, we are giving a signal to people, a message. In the midst of death, you need to affirm life. And ultimately, what's sprinkled is really the living water which has some ashes in it. Because what we want to do is to somehow invigorate the person, bring them, resuscitate the person, so that they will be able to somehow continue on. Despite the pain, despite the sudden crash in terms of experiencing reality, but as long as people are alive, they need to affirm the value of life. And they have to be able to learn to live with a contradiction. Yes, I believe that human beings are in the image of God. Yes, I believe that there is a God who is all-powerful, who is just and kind. The reality sometimes contradicts those beliefs, and I have to be able to live with those contradictions. I can't allow harsh realities to incapacitate me and to rob me of my human grandeur and my love of life. So that, in fact, the chok, which is mentioned in the beginning of the parsha, refers not only to the red heifer, but really it refers to life as we know it. Life is a chok. We do not fully understand why things happen. And yet we have to be able to live with those contradictions in our lives. And I now want to illustrate this with something which comes up later on in the parsha. This is a story in chapter 20. In the 40th year, after a whole generation has died in the desert, a new generation has sprung up. We have a story which seems to be on a certain level deja vu, of where the people are find themselves in a situation where there's no water. This is chapter 20, verse 2. And all of a sudden there's a mob scene where they gather on Moses and Aaron and they start fighting with them, complaining, challenging. Why have you taken us out of Egypt to bring us into this horrible place? And God says to Moses, take your staff, gather the people, and before their eyes you should speak to this rock and bring forth water. And then we're told in verse 9, 10, 11, how Moses does that. He strikes the rock twice, water comes out, the people drink, but then all of a sudden in verse 12, God says to Moses and Aaron, because you did not sanctify me before the Jewish people, because you did not believe in me, you will not come to the land which I am giving them. You will not bring them into that land. This verse, very, very difficult. The first thing is, it immediately poses the question, what did Moses and Aaron do wrong? And there are numerous explanations that are given by the commentaries which show how this is something which is very, very ambiguous in the text. And to suggest a few, Rashi says, well, the problem is they hit the rock. They were told to speak to the rock. Maimonides says, the problem is that they lost their cool. When they call the people, you rebels, they should have been in control of their faculties. They shouldn't have gotten angry. Another explanation that Nachmanides brings down, Rabbeinu Hananel, is that they mention that will we bring forth water from the rock, which was misleading. They should have made it clear that it's God who's bringing it forth. I'm not interested now in going into an analysis of these explanations. In another podcast, we'll deal with it. What I'm interested in is, whichever explanation you give, the punishment, though, seems to be very, very harsh, whichever one it is. Is that a reason, enough of a reason, why Moses and Aaron should now be denied entry into the land of Israel? Moses and Aaron, who've worked so hard, taking the Jews out of Egypt, bringing them through the desert, receiving the Torah, entering into a covenantal relationship at Sinai, for 40 years raising a generation, servicing the temple, for one mistake, they forfeit entry into the land of Israel. The only explanation is, this is a chok. We don't understand it. They don't understand it. And the question is, can they accept it? And not only accept it, but continue on. And we find a very interesting thing. In chapter 21, Moses is told by God to begin the process of the entry into the land of Israel. The Jews will start moving up on the eastern side of the Jordan. And here also we have a very interesting example of a chok, where God says to Moses, you're approaching now the borders of your brothers, the children of Edom. Don't engage them in warfare. This is chapter 20, starting with verse 14. And even when the people of Edom refuse entry, and even threaten the Jews by gathering on the border with an army, the Jews are told they have to back down. And yet, later on in chapter 21, there are two kings, Sichon and Og, who also refuse to give the Jews rite of passage. And God gives them a green light to go and fight them and eventually take possession of their land. Why allow battle against Sichon and Og? Why forbid battle against Edom? We can come up with some explanations, but I would like to suggest this is also a chok, where ultimately maybe we don't understand it. Moses could have very easily said to God, I don't want to go fight Sichon and Og. I don't want to begin the process of taking possession of the land of Israel. Since you're not going to let me go in, let my replacement go ahead and do it. I finished my task. And yet what we find is, despite the fact that Moses is told, you will not enter the land, Moses is determined to continue leading the Jewish people until the day he dies. Moses is determined to set the stage for the entry into the land, to even begin the process of conquest and of taking possession, even though he will not be in a position to complete it. And therefore, Moses becomes a model that even when you're confronted with a harsh reality, which is very painful, which seems to be irrational, which could very well incapacitate you, at a certain point, one needs to confront that and to be able to move on. And as long as they have the breath of life, to maximize that. Even when they know that the work of their hands will not come to its finished stage when they're alive, but they have to plant the seeds. And they have to be able to accept the role that they've been placed in and maximize it. This is the message of our parsha. It's a message which I think is a very important message to be able to acknowledge reality with all of its difficulties, but at the same time to be able to move on with life, with a vision, to be able to live with the contradictions of life and death. Unfortunately, living in Israel, over the past few years, we have certainly had the experience of much suffering, of many victims of terror. And I speak also on a personal level. There have been quite a few people who I've known directly or indirectly who unfortunately have been killed in terror attacks, wounded. And yet somehow we have to be able to find the strength to be able to say, but we need to go on. And as long as we have the gift of life to be able to value it and to maximize our potential, and to never lose sight of the fact that human beings do have dignity and grandeur. And our challenge is to actualize that to the best of our abilities. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Please tell your friends about this podcast series, and please let us know your thoughts and comments. Send us email via podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks to Dr. David Bernstein, who is the executive producer of the Pardes from Jerusalem podcast series. Shalom and goodbye from Jerusalem.